The burden is on the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act lawfully in self-defense. And you must be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt from all of the evidence in this case that the risk was unreasonable.
That was Judge Bruce Schroeder of the Kenosha County Circuit Court in Wisconsin delivering instructions to the jury in the case of Kyle Rittenhouse. As you're probably aware, Rittenhouse was accused and ultimately acquitted of multiple counts of intentional and attempted homicide, as well as endangering safety in connection with shootings that occurred during civil unrest in Kenosha in August 2020. In the clip, Judge Schroeder references the standard of reasonable doubt, a concept which is one of the pillars of our modern justice system. In this installment of Crown and Crozier, we take a closer look at the origins of reasonable doubt and discover that its original purpose was actually not about determining the facts of a given criminal case, but was more about shielding the souls of judges and jurors from eternal damnation. Indeed, reasonable doubt is the fruit of a fascinating theological tradition from the Middle Ages, and thus forms part of the rich inheritance that has been passed down over the centuries by the Catholic Church. For this episode, we're joined by Dr. James Whitman, who serves as Ford Foundation Professor at Yale University's Law School. He is the author of The Origins of Reasonable Doubt, Theological Roots of the Criminal Trial. Two quick editor's notes. First, towards the end of the interview, I misattributed a quotation. "Act as if everything depends on you and pray as if everything depends on God" is in fact attributed to St. Ignatius of Loyola, not St. Augustine. Mea maxima culpa. Second, following our discussion with Dr. Whitman, be sure to continue listening as we provide a short bonus feature, which helps further illuminate the concept of reasonable doubt and serves as an opportunity to reflect on how the beautiful teachings and traditions of our faith have helped shape the essential ideas and institutions which we often take for granted in our present day. Thanks so much, and without further ado, please enjoy this installment of the podcast on church, state, and faithful citizenship.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant at God's first.
Dr. James Whitman, thanks so much for joining us here on Crown and Crozier. Great to have you.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So this episode marks another installment in a recurring series here on Crown and Crozier where we say, to heck with current events, we are going to cast our glance back at the very intriguing period of history known as the Middle Ages. And yet, it's always a delight when we do this in casting our glance back and thinking we're just going to depart from the tyranny of current events. Invariably, our discoveries and our conversations involve some kind of delightful discovery of the immensely rich legacy of that era in shaping ideas and institutions which form the foundation of so much of our common life in the present day. So I'm confident this conversation is going to be no exception to that. We're looking at one of the bedrock principles of our 21st century system of justice, the concept of reasonable doubt, and how that's part of the inheritance which we owe to the Middle Ages and to Christendom. Now, as you mentioned in your book, The Origins of Reasonable Doubt, Theological Roots of the Criminal Trial, notwithstanding the fact that reasonable doubt is so central to our system of administering justice, it can actually be a little bit tricky to define, even for practitioners. If you don't mind me putting you on the spot, maybe just to get us started, perhaps you can give us a brief definition of reasonable doubt as it's applied in our courts today.
I can't. And in fact, as a lawyer, I'm not permitted to do so. It's a matter of the common law tradition. You're entirely right in saying that reasonable doubt is extremely difficult to define. People make efforts. The problem, of course, is that there's always some doubt. The difficulty is in explaining what might count as reasonable doubt or unreasonable doubt. Jurors are often quite baffled by this and have been known to send notes out to judges begging for some definition of reasonable doubt. And of course, some sort of definition you would think is needed, since on the basis of the reasonable doubt standard, persons are sentenced to prison and to die even. Obviously, it matters a great deal how we understand this standard, as we say, a standard and not a rule exactly. And yet, the strong common law tradition, I don't know what goes on in Canada, I have to say, but the strong common law tradition in the UK and in most states of the United States is that it is completely forbidden to define exactly what reasonable doubt might mean, no matter how much the jury may beg. No matter how much the jury may beg, the jury is simply to be told to make a decision beyond a reasonable doubt. At times, lawyers, prosecutors in particular, make an effort to define it. They'll say something like, you know, well, it's as though you had a jigsaw puzzle made up of 500 pieces and 10 pieces are missing or something like that. The ordinary rule in the common law is that it is error for the judge to permit any sort of explanation of that kind to be offered to the jurors. They simply must be thrown upon their own best understanding of what beyond a reasonable doubt might mean. And I'll just repeat what I said before. This ought to seem to anybody a troubling state of affairs. Entering criminal convictions against defendants is a troubling business, a disturbing business, and surely it ought to be done on the basis of well-understood law.
Well, my understanding was, I thought in your average criminal trial these days, I mean, as part of the instructions that are given to a jury, does nobody kind of throw them a lifeline or throw them a bone in terms of some kind of definition or some kind of parameters? Would one of the lawyers or counsels or the judge do that?
Ordinarily not, but again, and I can only speak of American law. Mm-hmm. I wish I knew
Canadian. No, I imagine it's pretty similar here, many of the practices.
It varies from state to state somewhat in the United States, but the ordinary rule is that no definition can be offered. The Supreme Court has discussed the issue from time to time without by any means resolving it. The Supreme Court has rejected one older formula that used to go hand in hand, or effectively rejected one formula that used to go hand in hand with beyond a reasonable doubt, which was to a moral certainty.
Mm.
The Supreme Court has expressed a lot of doubt about whether or not anybody could possibly understand what to a moral certainty means. Maybe in this podcast we can describe what to a moral certainty once meant, but it has no clear meaning to anybody today. But I've got to say, it's not obvious that beyond a reasonable doubt has any much clearer a meaning than to a moral certainty does.
I mean, that's just incredibly fascinating. One of the fulcrums of our legal system, and it's mired in this ambiguity or opaqueness, and maybe you get a different definition depending on who you ask. And yet, as you say, there's so much that hinges on that. Among other things, as you bring to light in the book, it just kind of adds to the lore. It adds to the mystery or the intrigue of this particular concept. Let's look into its genesis, its origins. What you highlight in your book is that the concept of reasonable doubt is steeped in this very interesting, very distinct theological tradition, the theology of blood. Tell us more what you mean by that.
It is indeed steeped in a theological tradition. The rule is originally a rule of Christian theology. There are parallels, it has to be said, in other religious traditions as well. The rule originally didn't have to do with law in the way we speak of law today, and exactly as you say, it had to do with anxiety over blood guilt. There is a deeply rooted tradition in Christianity, and I'll just say once again, we find parallels in other religions as well, of anxiety over the shedding of blood. Blood can, of course, be shed in many, many ways. Blood can be shed in war. Blood can be shed various sorts of violent crime. And blood can also be shed through criminal punishment. The concern, going back to the Greek church fathers, I mean, beyond anything I think we really want to discuss here, and indeed also found in the Jewish tradition, is that the shedding of blood could pollute the person who had been responsible for the bloodshed. Much of the discussion of this danger of pollution, which in the Catholic tradition in particular, will become a danger to salvation. Mm-hmm. It's important to make the distinction between pollution and salvation. But if we read, for example, Cyprian, we'll see that it's the orientation is still toward pollution and less toward salvation in the way we think about it. But at any rate, there is a long tradition of concern about shielding those who shed blood from the resulting guilt. This doesn't involve only judges by any means. It also involves, and in some ways particularly involves, soldiers. Soldiers are in the business of shedding blood. And in the ancient tradition that culminates really in the theology of St. Augustine, you see a great deal of discussion of the problem that that arises out of the fact that soldiers must shed blood. And you also see a great deal of discussion that starts from the assumption that judges are just like soldiers.
Hmm.
Now, as your hearers may know, you may know yourself, St. Augustine in particular was deeply engaged in developing a theory of just war, whose orientation, we must understand now, was not like our orientation in speaking about the law of war. It wasn't to some extent, but it largely involved the problem of how individual soldiers could avoid the risk to their salvation that would be posed by the fact that they killed people in war. War was about killing people. And for that reason, the theory of just war that Augustine developed is a theory of conscience. It's a theory of what the soldier must know, must be sure of, before shedding the blood of another. Augustine didn't doubt that there were legitimate ways that blood could be legitimately shed in warfare, but it had to be done in the right circumstances. Judges too shed blood, though, and the theological concerns were no different when it came to judges. And you find the discussion of soldiers and judges going hand in hand in his writings and in writings of others too from the time. Why did judges shed blood? Judges shed blood because the ordinary punishments in the past, really until the 18th century, involved either execution or mutilation. We talk a lot about execution these days because we're still concerned with the death penalty. But mutilation was very, very common. Terrible stuff. You cut off a person's hand, cut off a person's nose, cut off a person's ears. It's worth emphasizing, and again, I know I have Canadian listeners here, so that referring to American law may not have the impact that one.
Oh, might we have listeners all over the world, all over the Anglosphere.
Well, at least I'm speaking to some whose sensibilities have been formed in the more civilized world north of the border. I'll put it that way. But at any rate, you'll notice if you read the American Constitution, the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution refers to punishments of life or limb. That's because it was still taken for granted at the time of the American founding that people would be mutilated as a punishment, and they were. Now, of course, both mutilation and execution involve the shedding of blood, so that the dangers to one's salvation involved or posed by going to war were also the dangers to one's salvation posed by acting as a judge. And that meant that the same considerations of conscience that came into play for soldiers came into play for judges as well. They had to be sure that they were doing things in the correct way in order to avoid the risk that they themselves would be damned.
And taking this one step further, in your book, you talk about how a unique practice during the Middle Ages, the early Middle Ages in particular, of the theology of blood as it relates to judges and the sentences they meted out was the ordeal. And the ordeal, yes. The ordeal was a uniquely, distinctly medieval, middle-age form of punishment. Meaning of that word has evolved over the centuries where it's just come to mean some kind of unique or extraordinary trial or tribulation. But the ordeal was a very concrete form of punishment in the Middle Ages. Speak a little bit more to that if you could.
Yeah, I should say it's a form of judgment and not a form of punishment.
Okay.
I mean, there's some debate about whether we would call it a form of punishment exactly. But it's a form of judgment. In fact, it's still the word for judgment in German, Urteil, ordeal.
That's interesting.
It's a form of judgment. It's a way of, I don't know how much complexity I should introduce into my discussion of this. It's actually quite a complex and interesting institution. But technically, in medieval legal thought and theological thought, it's called a judgment of God. The way the ordeal worked was that the accused, if we think of a criminal matter, would make a sworn statement claiming innocence. In order to judge whether that statement was true, claimant, the proband, as we say, would be put to the ordeal. Now, the classic ordeals were in particular the ordeal of the hot iron and the ordeal of the cold water. In the ordeal of the cold water, the accused was bound up in a fetal position, tossed into a pool of water, and there were pools of water next to churches all over Western Europe for this purpose. If the accused person sank, that meant that God held the accused person to be truthful. If the accused person floated, that meant that God held the accused person to be untruthful and therefore guilty.
So it was left in God's hands, as it were, for the truthfulness to be...
They put it a little bit differently. They called it tempting God. And it made some theologians in the High Middle Ages very, very uncomfortable who attacked this because it was a matter of tempting God. So the underlying idea, I guess we can leave aside the hot iron. It's a horrific ordeal.
I'm guessing it involves some kind of branding or an application.
No. What you did there, I guess you may want to hear about it, is that you put an iron rod, you heated an iron rod in fire or in the forge until it was white hot. The proband, again, the accused, the person who had sworn the oath that was being tested, was then required to grip the hot iron in his hand. It was almost always used for males, so I can say he. And then walk several paces and then drop the iron. The hand would, of course, be badly burned. The hand would then be bound up. 3 days later, the bandages would be taken off. If the wound was healing, that was taken as a sign that God regarded the statement as having been given truth, as having been given truthfully. If not, not. Pretty painful. Not technically a punishment, you can see, but a way of getting God to weigh in on the truthfulness of what the proband had said. The reason that theologians condemned this as tempting God was because the underlying idea was God had no choice but to intervene in order to help a person who had been put into these circumstances. But we should not put God in a position where God would be required to act. This was the later theological, among other aspects of it, this is the later theological objection to the proceeding. Now, what I want to emphasize is the place that this served within the theology of reasonable doubt that we've been discussing. Medievalists, historians, spent a lot of time debating exactly why this creepy procedure was used. I won't go into all of the arguments here, but it's very clear when we read the sources that a large part of the reason was, maybe the most important reason, in my view, was to shift the responsibility for making judgment off the shoulders of the human beings and onto God. Let God be the one who says this person is guilty once again, because human beings, in making the judgment that the person was guilty, might be risking their own salvation, might be subjecting themselves to blood guilt. So the beauty of the procedure was that it made it unnecessary for any human being to run such risks.
That's important to bear in mind. It had an original purpose, which may be difficult for us moderns to grasp, looking back hundreds of years. So it had that original purpose. It had that original appeal in terms of shielding folks from potentially putting their own salvation in jeopardy. But as you say in the book, I mean, over time, and as you just mentioned, it was the subject of hot debate, and it fell out of favor, as it were. Is there anything more to know in terms of that journey, that process of the ordeal falling out of favor and the thinking that went behind what should replace it?
Yeah, so lots. The ordeal was effectively abolished, not formally abolished, in one of the great events in Western history, in legal history, in religious history. Everybody should know about it, the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215. Mm-hmm. Which really transformed the world. The Fourth Lateran Council did many, many things. Among other things, it introduced the requirement of universal confession, which is, of course, extremely important in the Catholic tradition and in Christianity much more broadly. It was an extraordinarily important, effective, new legal founding of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I know. Even in my adult life as a Catholic, it certainly dawned on me reading your book and having some of these other conversations with other guests on the Middle Ages, just how little we Catholics know about the Fourth Lateran Council. I think the big councils that stick out to us are Vatican II, Trent, maybe some of the early ones, Nicaea, Ephesus. But Lateran is right up there, as you say. And if nothing else, we hope that these types of conversations will inspire some of our brethren to go learn more about the Fourth Lateran Council, because it was so essential for reform of the medieval church and clerics who were falling into misdeeds or weak discipline. A lot of the practices and the expectations for the ordained just to fulfill their office properly and justly, a lot of that was articulated at Fourth Lateran Council. But sorry, I cut you off.
Oh, no, it's fine. You're absolutely right. And I think I can join the chorus in preaching the importance of the Fourth Lateran Council, and also in recommending to your listeners, if they visit Rome, which is generally to be recommended, that they bear in mind that the home of the papacy in the Middle Ages was the Lateran and not the Vatican, And the Lateran is toward the south in Rome. It's magnificent. And it was unfortunately damaged by fire at one point, but it's really very, very much worth visiting.
So is it fair to say ordeals are banned at Fourth Lateran?
Not exactly. So what happened at the Fourth, exactly as you said, the core concern at the Fourth Lateran and of church reform more broadly in those centuries is with priests, is with maintaining the proper holy character of the priesthood, about which many, many, many things can be said. But in particular, the Fourth Lateran Council demands, insists, orders that priests not be involved in the shedding of blood.
Mm.
This was not just a matter of the ordeals. In fact, that the critical canon in the Fourth Lateran Council, mistranslated for years, which mystifies me, begins by saying that priests may not serve as captains of armed bands. They did that. I mean, you know, there were priests going out there with a mace or, you know, even swords and fighting. And it was a matter of great concern to the church that priests not do this. And in addition, in the same canon, that they not involve themselves in ordeals, judgments of blood. Now, it was understood to be necessary that a priest preside at ordeals. That's a rule that goes back, once again, quite far in the early Middle Ages. I suppose you could have had ordeals without priests, but you had priests. Without priests, it was impossible to conduct the ordeals. Something had to be done instead. Now, there's a long, interesting, complicated medieval history of what alternatives emerged. But in England in particular, jury trial emerged as the alternative. The jurors, it was no longer possible to demand a verdict from God, it would be called the verdict of God. Jurors instead were charged with the responsibility of coming up with the verdict of guilty or not guilty. And if you'll allow me to give you a little more legal history, that had an extremely important consequence, which matters very much down to the present day. When God gives a verdict through the ordeal or any other means, God gives what we call the general verdict, that is either guilty or not guilty. And God does not give reasons for the verdict. God simply declares the person to be not guilty, as the case may be. The same is still true of the common law jury, which simply declares guilty or not guilty without giving reasons. That could be regarded as troubling in itself, speaking of troubling aspects of this heritage. And in fact, convicting persons criminally without giving specific reasons for the conviction, as we do in the common law world, is quite clearly a violation of the European Convention on Human Rights.
Yeah, so, I mean, among other things, 1215 is a big year, particularly in the Anglosphere, which is where we want to focus this conversation. I mean, you have the Lateran Council towards the end of the year, around the month of November. But as we've explored in a separate podcast episode, which I'll put in a plug here for, back in June, it was the Magna Carta. The Magna Carta was ratified in England. And as we know, I mean, so much of the civil law in England was influenced by that. And I can't help but think that the combination of those two events unfolding, I mean, 6 months of each other, would have had profound implications for the people in England. It seems worth observing that, or making reference, as you so eloquently said in the book, perhaps in parallel or in tandem with the theology of blood, there was another theological tradition that was forming or percolating over the centuries as well, and that was the theology of doubt. And the Pope who convened the Fourth Lateran Council, Innocent III, it seemed like he had some important things to say. I think it was in the context perhaps of actually disciplining some of his priests or his bishops, where Innocent III himself said, or he made a famous statement, when there are doubts, one must choose the safer path. And this is in relation to discipline and meting out justice. Can you speak a little bit more to that, how the theology of doubt was forming perhaps in parallel, in conjunction with this theology of blood, and again, how Fourth Lateran was a seminal moment in that evolution?
That's a perfect question. Unfortunately, I'm not sitting in my office at Yale. If I were, I could get out my Innocent III bobblehead to inspire me.
We should all have one of those.
Everybody should have one of those. Yes, indeed. It's shocking that they're not more widely owned. You're exactly right. I mean, you ask exactly the right question. Did indeed develop during the Middle Ages safer path theology revolving around the problem of doubt. And the formulation is the one that you've already given. or I'll add something to the formulation. The basic idea in safer path theology is that in cases of doubt, it's better not to act at all. Any of the listeners, I hope, can understand what the sources of that theological notion might be. If we're not absolutely sure that what we're doing will not risk our salvation, to speak of it in conscience terms, or more broadly, simply risk doing evil in objective terms, it's better simply not to act in the absence of certainty. This is a rule that could, of course, apply in many, 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 many realms of life. It is going to feed into the reasonable doubt rule that emerged in the form in which we know it by the end of the 18th century in the common law world. What I'd like to emphasize about it is that it involves concepts of doubt and certainty, which are not exactly like the concepts of doubt and certainty we use in the empirical sciences or in making purely fact-based judgments of guilt. And it's very important to work through the different dynamics of, well, conscience, really, that are involved here. If I'm making a decision about the truth of a factual proposition, like, you know, there's a black hole at the center of our galaxy or whatever it might be, there'll always be some doubt. I mean, scientists are never absolutely unanimous about anything whatsoever. You know, you go with the weight of opinion. In making factual judgments, somebody often will disagree. It's part of the ordinary. It reflects the incapacities of human beings that we can't be absolutely certain about how the world works. Nevertheless, we have to act. I mean, you know, you have to do things because, as a pragmatic matter, the world has to be dealt with. If, by contrast, you're really worried about these large questions of salvation and good and evil, you're much, much, much less likely to act. You may find yourself insisting not on the sort of rule we have in science in which we'll go with the supermajority of scientific views. You may find yourself insisting on the rule that we have in jury trial of unanimity. Unless everybody absolutely agrees, we will not go along with this. Nobody should take any risk. So although the words doubt and the words certainty are also used in this theology, the actual implementation of these concepts of doubt and certainty takes inevitably a different form in this, when these theological concerns are the concerns lying in the background of the use of those terms. And that very much shows up in the safer path theology. You're absolutely right to link it to Innocent III. It, of course, has older roots and a very, very long subsequent history in the Christian tradition broadly, but especially in the Catholic tradition.
So going back to 1215, post Magna Carta, post Fourth Lateran, I think an important thing for us to bear in mind, again, which is the recurring theme in your book, is just how much of a risky business it was to be on a jury or to be involved in a criminal case or a civil case back in the Middle Ages. And this, of course, was something that would have weighed so heavily on those jurors. Can you speak a little bit more just to that context, that milieu in 1215? You know, what the mindset of juries were and the types of risks and apprehensions that were on their mind as this new experiment is taking off the ground.
So there are multiple, as your question suggests, multiple risks and apprehensions that would have been on their mind. Not all of them involve the theology that we're discussing. This is a world very much oriented toward vengeance norms. Anybody who votes to convict a criminal defendant can expect to be targeted by the defendant's family. That's not only true of the jurors, it's true of the judge. This is particularly important for the development of the unanimity rule that I just mentioned. It mattered a great deal to insist that all 12 jurors say guilty so that any individual one of them can say to the family members who might seek vengeance, it wasn't just I. Everybody said he was guilty. We mustn't forget that the fact that jurors faced that sort of risk back then. And I want to emphasize, we must forget that jurors still face that sort of risk. This is not a problem that's vanished in modern justice. It may be it's more pressing in some other parts of the world than it is in the United States, but it's also present in the United States.
Sure.
And it mustn't be ignored in trying to understand how we organize our trials. But for our purposes here, it's the theological concerns that matter especially, because they're the ones that lie in the background of the development of the reasonable doubt rule. So jurors were worried, really for a couple of different reasons. Now, the word juror refers to somebody who has taken an oath. Taking oaths was, to use the word they used, a perilous business in the view of the Middle Ages. If you slipped up, if you swore to something that was false, you were, once again, risking your salvation. And it's worth emphasizing, not with regard to the jurors, but others in the Middle Ages, that the oath-taking was done in an intimidating way. You know, so they would, in many of these, they would bring out the body of a saint, you know, ask you to place your hands on the body and swear. I mean, this is scary stuff.
Yeah, taking an oath on a relic is not something you do lightly.
Yeah, it wasn't just a little relic. They would bring out the whole body there, right? I mean, jurors probably didn't do that. They just swore an oath in the way that we swear oaths now. But even beyond that, there's the concern we've been talking about throughout, and it's very much there. The concern that if one made an error in convicting and sending the defendant and subjecting the defendant to a blood punishment, one suffered blood guilt of one's own, which could result in all of the evils we've been discussing. The theology took this in a deeper direction as well. If you'll allow me, you haven't asked me about it, but I'll say so anyway.
Please.
That had great bearing on how all of this developed. And that had to do with the concept of conscience. Now, I've mentioned conscience before. Conscience in Latin, so it's conscientia or scientia, however you want to pronounce the Latin. And scientia is knowing, it's knowledge. Now, we think in the modern English language of conscience just as knowledge of right and wrong. And of course, there's lots of theology about how we know it and so on and so forth. But we've lost the sense that it just involves knowledge of facts. But in the Middle Ages, both senses were very much present in the mind. The risk of convicting an innocent person, or arguably innocent person, was also the risk of making use of one's erroneous knowledge of the facts, or making judgments about the facts. Jurors were, of course, in the business of making statements about facts. This person is guilty. And the theology, as it developed in the continent, made a very sharp distinction between making judgments about facts and making judgments of guilt. According to the theologians, it was extremely important in order to preserve the salvation, safeguard the salvation of judges, that the judges never use their own knowledge of facts, but simply make their judgment on the basis of the facts formally developed on the record through the what became quite an elaborate medieval law of evidence. This, again, had to do with the judge's salvation. Mm. Thomas Aquinas talks about this a great deal. If a judge knows facts, according to Aquinas, it's shocking to us, if the judge knows facts that would lead to the acquittal of the defendant, but the evidentiary record developed in court indicates the defendant must be convicted. The theological tradition, preceding Aquinas would typically say he's still got to convict. He can't use his own knowledge, because if he used his own knowledge, he would be risking his own salvation. Aquinas tries to find it out, but it's an extremely difficult problem for him, and was an extremely difficult problem in the Middle Ages. And it's worth emphasizing that it was an extremely difficult problem because judges often knew lots of facts about the case.
Well, as you say in the book, I mean, judges, not always, but often they were priests and they heard confessions and they may have heard some kind of disclosure of secret sensitive facts from an individual who then goes on trial and they're not permitted to disclose that.
Worse yet, they may have heard a confession to the crime by somebody who's not on trial.
Yeah.
They know perfectly well somebody else did it. Even beyond that, these are small communities. You know, I mean, the judge lives among people, do things. The risk to the judge was very, very, very great for that reason. What happened on the continent was that the rule developed that I just described in talking about Aquinas, namely, well, but we're going to preserve the judge from the risks to his salvation by saying he simply doesn't act on his own knowledge. Mm-hmm. And the formula that emerged in the Middle Ages, what the judge was to say in his own mind, sometimes the defendant is, it is the law who condemns you and not I.
Right. And that harkens all the way back to Augustine.
To the ordeals, right? Well, oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. Augustine or Augustine as you prefer. Augustine is a little closer to the Latin.
Sure. My son is Augustine, so that's typically what's on the tip of my tongue.
I take no position on the pronunciation.
Yeah. Potato, potato. It would have been Augustine.
Augustinus in antiquity. at any rate, I would say it not only goes back in that sense to the 4th century or the early 5th century, it goes back to the ordeals too. Right? The point of the ordeal in some sense is to say it is God that condemns you and not I. Mm-hmm. Now in this theology, you can say it is the law that condemns you and not I. The common law jury trial looks very different because the jurors, and here again, I must explain a little bit of the history. We think of jurors now we demand that jurors not know anything about the facts in the case. They're supposed to be a blank slate. That rule really only took hold in the 19th century.
Wow.
The medieval jury was, as we say, self-informing. The jury was supposed to be a panel of witnesses who knew what had happened.
Mm.
So the jurors were, I could say much more, but there's a theology of witnesses that's lying in the background of that too. So the jurors, by definition, were violating the principle that judges were never supposed to violate. They were both the people who knew what happened and the people who were saying the fateful word, guilty, which meant that the risk to them was extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't mean that they were necessarily damned. Again, we're talking about safer path theology here. It could be that, 11 out of 12 people would have said this person was guilty. And, for most human affairs, that's good enough. But if you're worried about these questions of conscience, it's not.
Yeah, one of the reminders, which I thought was very compelling, hammering home this point of just how seriously the question of conscience and salvation was on the minds of folks in the Middle Ages. Just bear in mind, what Dante was saying in his poetry at that time, false witnesses ended up in the eighth circle of hell. Like this was,
you bet.
This was no light matter. So you keep using the word formula, and a central theme of your book is that reasonable doubt, as we know it today, has its origins as a moral comfort formula, not a fact-finding procedure, but a moral comfort formula. In a nutshell, that seems like the central takeaway and the argument of your book. Reasonable doubt is about moral comfort, not about fact-finding. And in some way or another, kind of the story after Lateran Council is just how that concept played out and continued to evolve and be implemented right up until the time of, the founding of the United States, the founding of Canada in the 19th century, after the English Glorious Revolution in the late 17th century. It was that formula, that understanding of moral comfort that carried reasonable doubt forward. Is that a fair characterization?
It certainly is. And it's part of the reason why the old formula, the other formula, moral certainty, was used all the time as well. And you see this deep into the 18th century. Once again, the purpose of the reasonable doubt rule, the moral certainty rule, either version, the purpose was not to protect the defendant. It was to protect the jurors against the dangers involved in judging. And you can see this. We have in particular what are called the Old Bailey records. If any of your listeners have an interest in history of criminal law, I can only recommend as warmly as possible that they look at the Old Bailey records, which are available online. They're fantastic. From the later 18th century in England, you can see all of these extraordinary trials and events transpiring before your eyes in these transcripts. And we see judges instructing jurors, and the judges will say to the jurors, the gentlemen, it is, of course, extremely anxiety-inducing and uncomfortable for you to contemplate convicting in this case. And you may have doubts, but as long as your doubts are not reasonable doubts, you needn't worry about them. It'll be easier for you. Your souls can rest easy as long as your doubts are not reasonable. And there's a great deal of theological background to that, particularly in the 17th and 18th century, which we can track by looking to sermons, things. So there's a lot of discussion of this in the sermon literature. And of course, people heard sermons all the time. And the sermons will say, what is a doubt that can be discarded as not a reasonable doubt? That's a wonderful passage by one of the great sermon writers of the 17th century. Well, it's like when a squeamish woman, I hope you're listeners will forgive me. They spoke differently of women in those days. Squeamish woman is holding a toad or something like that, and she wants to squeal and drop it, and no amount of telling her that the toad can't hurt her will have any effect on her reaction. It's like that. It's, you know, it's pure irrational squeamishness. That's what we mean by an unreasonable doubt. Mm. And jurors, of course, might also feel that. They might say, oh my gosh, I mean, what will happen if I send this person to be executed or mutilated? But don't worry about it. Just go ahead and convict. That's the message.
Keeping with the theme of, you know, how reasonable doubt evolved following Fourth Lateran Council all the way up to the time of the American Revolution, one of the vignettes in your book that I thought was the most enjoyable and most illuminating, the year was 1770. There had just been a skirmish in Boston that came to be known as the Boston Massacre. British troops fired on some American colonists who, depending on who you ask, may have been in the rabble-rousing mode and may have provoked the troops. But anyway, it was future U.S. President John Adams who defended the British troops in this very famous case. And there's almost, I mean, there's a distinct echo of Pope Innocent III in what Adams said in the courtroom, namely that where you are doubtful, do not act. And among other things, I just thought, you know, how powerful and compelling that was coming from a future U.S. president defending British troops who had just injured and killed a few U.S. colonists. Also, I couldn't help take some delicious irony, given that many of the American founding fathers weren't that fond of the papacy and the Catholic faith. I mean, here you have John Adams echoing the words of Pope Innocent III. It was such a delightful vignette.
Wholeheartedly agree with what you say. It's a delightful vignette. And to mention also that Adams actually knew quite a lot of canon law and was very interested in it and wrote about it. But, you know, the tale of John Adams would probably take us outside the limits of this discussion. But yes, it is. It's remarkable. People really, in the late 18th century, in the early 19th century, remained extremely uncomfortable about the prospect of convicting. What's changed more than anything else in the modern world is that we've lost all of that moral anxiety, you know, or at least a lot of the moral anxiety. I don't think it's... It can't be entirely gone. I mean, we know it's not entirely gone in the minds of potential jurors. We see this in particular with what's called death penalty qualification for jurors. That is, jurors will be excluded from a death penalty jury if they express anxiety about sending people to die.
Right.
It's hard to imagine a more fundamental rejection of... of the theological tradition we've been describing here, which was rooted in the idea that one must never do that. But they have it. It's forgotten.
Now, just speaking of that change and things being forgotten, I mean, if we fast forward from the time of John Adams defending British troops in the year 1770 to today, you know, I think it's a fair statement, and you acknowledge this in your book. When it comes to reasonable doubt, there's been a lot. That's a heck of a lot that's been lost in translation. Do you think it's as simple to say that a primary cause in that has just been the decline in, one might say, public morality, or maybe public religiosity, or the practice of religion, a decline in the practice of the Christian faith? How do we make sense of the fuzziness that surrounds reasonable doubt in our present day? And then the corresponding question to that is, in light of that fuzziness, is it still a relevant standard? If it was developed for a certain purpose and we're not using it for that purpose now, does that call into question its efficacy or its appropriateness?
You know, of course, answering that question would not only require hours and hours. Yes. I'm not sure that anybody could come up with a with a perfect answer to the question. And, you know, the decline of religiosity in the modern world is a riveting and difficult topic. Mm-hmm. Working through its consequences in this and other areas is a, you know, challenge that you could devote an entire scholarly career to and still fail. You know, it's very, very hard. That won't stop me from responding to your question.
Please.
But it's just a way of starting apologetically before trying to answer it. So obviously there's been a decline in religiosity. Obviously there is less concern with the sorts of anxieties with regard to salvation that used to motivate people. That can't be true of every single individual human being, you know, but it's obviously broadly true, and it plays a role in all of this. It's also true that the connection between law and morality, especially in criminal law, has been seriously and questioned and attacked in a sustained way. So a lot of the, and I would have to say more about it than I can say here, but the drive, especially in the 20th century, was to get the moralizing out of criminal law.
Right.
And in particular, with regard to the jury, the drive was to make sure that the jury was simply making factual determinations and not making moral judgments of the defendant before the jurors, before the jury. And that expresses itself in all sorts of changes in terminology. For example, if you go back to the early 20th century, the word wicked was used quite a great deal. We never use the word wicked any longer. We try to ask the jurors really unanswerable questions about what factually was going on in the mind mm-hmm. of the defendant. You can't ever answer those questions, but the idea is the jurors should just be making factual determinations. That reflects more broadly a notion that somehow law should be more like science or more like fact-finding or something like that. It also, of course, reflects the fact that the question of what counts as good and evil is now a question answered by reference to statutes passed by the legislature. Now, I mean, you can make the argument that those statutes do and should conform to larger understanding of morality, but as a matter of the legal technique, the way we resolve these questions, all we're supposed to do any longer is ask what the legislature wants. So that all of these old theological checks have no more place in the way, you know, I teach my students criminal law. I can't teach them to do these things because you don't do it. They're gone. Other things have happened too that would require too long to describe. I mean, I'll just say in some of my writings after that book, I've tried to argue, I mean, this will seem questionable without giving the full argument, but I'll tell you that where we organize our criminal law these days around the presumption of innocence, and the presumption of innocence is, of course, very important, we should be oriented more toward a presumption of mercy.
Wow. Mm.
And that indeed, if we try to understand why, I read a lot about continental European systems, why continental European law is so much less punitive, so much less harsh than American criminal law, what we have to understand is that the presumption of mercy is really what operates in those systems. Now, explaining what that means requires us to go much more deeply into how the systems work than I can really do here. But that's the form in which I think it's possible to argue now for a return to the older way of looking at things. I mean, one can't work with a uniform social commitment to older Christian ideas. It's a non-starter. I mean, it's not going to happen that way. But I, you know, you might disagree with that, and others are welcome to disagree too. And there are plenty of Americans who think we can Christianize the U.S., but I don't think that's a possibility. But there are values that we can draw from the older tradition, and the older tradition, especially the Augustinian tradition, is extraordinarily rich, extraordinarily humane, and does offer us material out of which we can build, you know, not a self-described Christian order, but one which is learned from this, you know, sensational body of thought, much of which is hidden in the obscurity of the Latin language, but not all, and which is there for us.
Well, just on that point of the possibility of re-Christianizing the U.S., I'll just leave you with the old saying that all things are possible with God. So we'll see what he has in store for us and for the country in the future.
And I'll just respond quickly by saying, but we mustn't shift the responsibility onto the shoulders of God. It's on our own.
That's true. Well, if I could echo our friend Augustine once more, I mean, he had the famous quote about act as if everything depends on you and you pray as if everything depends on God.
There you have it.
If nothing else, I thought, having had this 101 survey in the origins and the genesis of reasonable doubt, I just want to say I was really touched, and I thought it was very appropriate and pitch perfect tone in terms of your concluding thoughts in your book around, well, what does all this mean when the origins of reasonable doubt have been lost and forgotten, and perhaps we're too far gone to reclaim it. But if nothing else, I mean, the summons or the invitation, the challenge that you put out was that when a jury is rendering a verdict, just just bearing in mind the moral nature of that act, that is an inherent moral nature. If nothing else, you know, that is that's the type of recognition, the type of mindset, the type of mentality which we would benefit from reinstilling and adopting. So I thought that was very appropriate and very moving.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
Sure. Well, I was just going to conclude by saying, pardon the pun, but if there's one thing I know after these 50 minutes with you, beyond a reasonable doubt, this conversation has been a real joy. So thank you, Dr. Whitman, so much for being with us here today, for helping us rediscover one of the many beautiful gifts from the Middle Ages in Christendom that have been bequeathed to us, and this gift in the form of the reasonable doubt standard. We truly love on this show rediscovering and celebrating the connections between so much of our contemporary culture and how it is an inheritance from the eras in the past, and particularly the Middle Ages and the history of the church. So thank you so much for making that possible. And for all our listeners who want to take a deeper dive, please check out Dr. Whitman's book, The Origins of Reasonable Doubt, Theological Roots of the Criminal Trial. Once again, Dr. Whitman, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It has been a joy indeed.
Wait. Don't hit stop. This is normally where we do a shtick about subscribing, following us on Facebook or Twitter, leaving us a rating on Apple or Spotify, or referring us to a friend or two. That's all good advice that you should heed. But beyond that rigmarole, it's time for the special bonus content that we promised at the beginning. Here again is Judge Schroeder from Wisconsin providing the jury in the Kyle Rittenhouse case with more details on the concept of reasonable doubt. As you listen to his words, we invite you to reflect on how reasonable doubt, a hallmark of our criminal justice system, forms part of the treasury of riches that has been passed down by Holy Mother Church over the centuries.
The term reasonable doubt means a doubt based upon reason and common sense. It is a doubt for which a reason can be given, arising from a fair and rational consideration of the evidence or want of evidence. It means such a doubt as would cause a person of ordinary prudence to pause or hesitate when called upon to act in the most important affairs of life. A reasonable doubt is not a doubt which is based upon mere guesswork or speculation. A doubt which arises merely from sympathy or from fear to return a verdict of guilt is not a reasonable doubt. A reasonable doubt is not a doubt such as may be used to escape the responsibility of a decision. Examine the evidence and search for the truth, giving the defendant the benefit of every reasonable doubt.